sometimes behave so strangely. Hello and welcome to the So Strangely podcast on recent research in music and science. I'm Finn, and joining me today is Professor Amy Belfi from the Department of Psychological Science at Missouri University of Science and Technology. So, Amy, we're getting into an article that you recommended, White Matter Correlates of Music Anhedonia, Implications for Evolution of Music, by Louis Patterson, Sachs, Lung, Zen, and, oh, I'm very sorry, Spritzenda?
My apologies. I can't help you with that.
What is this about?
Yeah, so I thought this paper was really cool. When it first came out, I was excited about it. It's about musical anhedonia, and it looks at structural connectivity in the brain in a case study of a person who has musical anhedonia.
As I understand it, you've worked on anhedonia before. So can you give us an idea of what that really is about?
Musical anhedonia is super understudied. Like, there's literally like a handful of papers on it. And when I'm saying musical anhedonia, really, I'm using that to mean just people who don't like music.
Oh, okay.
So not people who hate music, but just people who don't really get any pleasurable or good feelings from listening to music. They just don't like it.
So when you're talking about anhedonia, you're not talking about a specific mechanism for not having pleasure. You're just saying these people don't experience pleasure with respect to whatever they're anhedonic to.
Right, right. And like, we don't really know the mechanism, at least for musical anhedonia at all. Kind of means really, a self-reported like lack of pleasure in response to music. In like patients who, you know, have a stroke and then they report like, I had the stroke and before the stroke, I liked music a lot and now I don't like music at all. And it's pretty distressing. Mm-hmm. And so I had access to a bunch of patients with brain damage in my PhD, and I thought like, well, so far there's only a handful of case studies. Let's try and do like a group level experiment and see if I can identify any consistencies with respect to where brain damage occurs that then results in musical anhedonia. So I took about 80 patients and just had them do a series of questionnaires, totally exploratory study. No predictions of where the damage might occur because there was really not much research to base those predictions off of. So, and I found that it was really actually rare. So out of 80 patients, there was one that kind of showed musical anhedonia, but otherwise people reported basically no changes in pleasure they derived from music after brain injury. And, and Psyche kind of makes a similar claim in her paper that it seems that really severe, you know, true musical anhedonia seems to be quite rare.
Naively, I would think that because music involves so many different things in the brain that you could kind of break it anywhere and it would cause changes. But I guess if you're looking for a particular type of lack of pleasure, then you can really focus down.
The way I interpret it is almost like the opposite or something.
Okay, like, yeah, sure, yeah.
I mean, and to me, the way I'm kind of interpreting the result of it being very rare is it makes sense when you think about, from my perspective, it seems like music therapy is used for almost any possible type of neurological disorder, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, whatever. And maybe the reason it's so therapeutic is that because people just like music and it's really hard to like disrupt the ability of liking music or whatever. Uh-huh. Even if you have a severe neurological damage, you're not likely to have anhedonia for music. And maybe that's one reason why music is like beneficial, like a therapeutic tool, because people just like it.
So the resilience of music around all of these different disorders suggests that there's a lot of strong connections that support it.
Yeah, that's kind of the way I'm interpreting it. But of course, so this is kind of all my background in this topic has been looking at what I would call the like acquired musical anhedonia. Yeah. So patients with neurological disorders. What this paper from Psyche and others' work has looked at what I would consider like more congenital anhedonia, just healthy people with healthy brains who just don't get anything out of music. And so maybe they would be less responsive to like something like music therapy. I don't think we really know that.
So as I understand it, there's really no connection between amusia, which is a difficulty in understanding essential components of musical structure, and anhedonia.
One way that, at least in my work, I've defined musical anhedonia is that it has to be separate from a perceptual deficit. So, right, like if you have severe hearing loss or something, well, then we might expect you to not like music. So the anhedonia part is really like this emotional deficit for music, irrespective of a perceptual deficit. And I think if you had anhedonia for music with a perceptual deficit, I think it would be less, I would be less likely to call that musical anhedonia, because then you really don't know if the dislike or just general apathy towards music is due to like an emotional deficit or is it a perception thing?
Yeah, there'd be different ways of explaining it and it'd be hard to tease that apart. Okay, so what are the main brain regions that are related to anhedonia from what you've studied and maybe that also come up in this article?
So yeah, what it seems to be from the one, there was like that one case in my paper that had damage to white matter structures in the striatum, which seems totally in line with what these other papers have found. Psyche's paper, and there's an fMRI paper from this Barcelona group, which is another group studying musical anhedonia. And it seems to be that there's something going on with connectivity between structures important for like reward and structures important for auditory processing. Yeah, so like these striatal regions that are part of this reward system and like the superior temporal gyrus and other important auditory regions. There's something about like the connections between those that are disrupted in musical anhedonia.
That's so cool that it's actually more a problem of connection than a regional spot, or, you know, from what you've seen or the cases that we've seen so far.
Yeah, it is really interesting because a question that's something that's really intriguing about musical anhedonia is that to be defined as musical anhedonia, it has to be selective. So it's not like these are people who have anhedonia just across the board for, you know, that would be an exclusion criteria. So these are people who just have something specific to music. So like if there, you would expect that there would be, you know, abnormalities or whatever in these reward structures, but that would affect pleasure across the board.
Right.
So
yeah,
something unique about musical anhedonia might be that it's this connectivity.
Are there other special types of anhedonia that have been seen that have been isolated?
That's a really good question. And honestly, I don't know the answer. I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't actually know. Not that I know of off the top of my head, but I don't want to speak too strongly on that point.
Yeah, well, I hear what you mean with the idea that anhedonia might be related to functioning, but specific anhedonia to, you know, distinct stimuli would, it would make sense that that would be a problem of connectivity, because it would be, you know, this pathway or this kind of stimulus wouldn't have an effect, whereas generally speaking, it would function well, your reward system. Now, we'll get into this more with Psyche later, but there's a connection that, or there's a topic that's coming up in this discussion that has to do with the evolution of music and the idea of trying to understand how maybe pleasurable responses have to do with how our musicality developed and played a role in the development of music and the development of language. Do you know anything about the mixed origins of music theory?
So I had never heard of this before I read this paper. That's something that I actually wanted to like ask Psyche about when we were having this discussion, because I don't know much about the evolutionary theories of music. So this was my first time seeing this when I read the paper.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So we'll get into that with Psyche. That's good. Sometimes there's neuroscience studies that seem to like record brains from a bunch of different people. And sometimes there's these studies of like one individual case study. How does that work in neuroscience? Like you said, you had access to stroke patients and then you found like one person that you could study. Is that typical for this sort of work in trying to understand how brains normally function?
The goal is always to study as many patients as possible or whatever. I don't know if we would call this BW with musical anhedonia patient, but sometimes there's certain, I don't know, disorders or whatever that are so rare that it's impossible to study more than one person. Mm-hmm. So like a kind of canonical case I would say would be like patient SM who has no amygdala on either side because of this extremely rare neurological disorder that basically, you know, like there's maybe four people in the entire world who have it. And we've learned a lot about the amygdala from SM. So it's extremely powerful when we have these really, really rare, unique cases. There's still something to be gained, even if we only have one person who we can study. A group would be ideal, but you can still learn a lot, especially if it's something that's super rare. So Saiki is kind of making the case that musical anhedonia is very rare, and that's what I found in like the acquired musical anhedonia. Mm-hmm. There are a couple other studies that are group studies of musical anhedonia, like from that Barcelona group. They have two PNAS papers, I think, with, I don't know how many participants they have, but a good number, maybe 20 with musical anhedonia or so. Mm. But then that gets into the question that's kind of brought up into this paper is how are we classifying people? Is it just the lower end of a spectrum, or is it this like categorically different thing? Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, case getting back to the point, case studies can be very useful in the cases where it's something that's so rare that you're not able to find a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, this paper, as I understand it, seems to bridge that. There's the study of this one case study where it's, mm-hmm. that's pretty clearly a case of music anhedonia. And then it's being paired with a study of, mm-hmm. I mean, people that we might consider to be normally hedonic to music, but that have a spectrum of response. The way that the Barcelona group seems to study a spectrum of sensitivity. So maybe do you want to give a quick outline of the paper?
So what I would say one of the goals of the paper is to look at structural connectivity in musical anhedonia and the case study and musical reward more generally, I guess, looking at this kind of natural variation in a healthy population of people. And one unique thing about this paper is there was a recent fMRI study looking at musical anhedonia that focused more on function and functional connectivity. And so I think one unique aspect of this paper was that it was looking at structural connectivity.
We normally talk about, or we most often talk about fMRI, which is functional connectivity, and there's less understanding of this, the things that we can get in looking at white matter.
Yeah, so fMRI, you're looking at the bold response, which is a proxy for neural responsiveness, in response to like, say, a task, listening to music or something. So this might just be looking at regions of activity in response to a music task. But functional connectivity is taking that fMRI data and looking at correlations between different regions. So like, let's say we take a region in this STG, an auditory region, and the nucleus accumbens, a region in the kind of reward system, and we see how does that activity correlate. And high correlation, we would call connectivity. So by contrast, structural connectivity is measuring the integrity of white matter tracks, actual structural connections between those regions. So I think it's good to do these kind of complementary methods because functional connectivity makes some assumptions, but we're not really sure how well it reflects actual connectivity. So this paper from Psyche is looking at the white matter structural connectivity in musical anhedonia. So I think it's a nice addition to this literature that people are just kind of starting now to build on this topic.
Yeah. So the study looked at both this extreme case with someone with pretty clear music anhedonia and then some sort of normal variation in a standard student population, and then compared very directly the white matter connectivity, I guess, parameters on a few key regions in the brain to behavioral measures. And so there was some kind of modeling that was happening between the behavioral measures and the strength of connection, the volume and I'm going to say FA, and then we're going to talk to Psyche about it because I don't understand the difference between those two.
Yeah.
we've got some things to learn here. But the way in which the modeling was done between those aspects of behavioral results and then these representations of anatomical connectivity seems to be pretty exciting there.
Yeah, I think something that I thought was really cool was how they were trying to predict BW's data based on the normal comparisons data, and like trying to use that to assess whether he falls within a continuum or is like an outlier. So I thought that was really cool that based on the model from the healthy populations data, they could try and predict BW's data. And I think his behavioral data was much lower than what would be predicted, but his brain data was really close to what they would predict. So there's kind of that association between behavioral and that like his behavioral data was so far below what he would predict, but his brain wasn't as abnormal as his behavior, I guess.
Yeah, that brings up all kinds of questions on sort of how effective is this kind of survey for measuring those extremes. You know, if the survey, because it was self-report, the way that people were measuring their responsiveness. But this will all be stuff I think that we'll get into with Psyche shortly. So we'll see what she has to say. And now joining us on the line is Psyche Louis, professor in the Department of Psychology and the Program in Neuroscience and Behavior at Wesleyan University, and also first author on this paper. So welcome, Psyche.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I guess let's get started right from the very beginning. How did this project come about?
There's a great story behind that. So I've always been interested in music and emotion because I think it's really central to why we listen to music and why we have music in our lives. And a previous student that I've supervised, Matt Sox, he did his senior thesis on music and chills. Like he wanted to know what makes some people get chills when they listen to music and other people not. And that was a really fun project. And when that got published, which was in 2016, BW, who is the subject that we studied in this paper, got in touch with me because Wesleyan had written up a blog post about this paper, the previous paper by Matt Sox. And when that blog post got disseminated, BW, who was married to a Wesleyan alum, saw this and he said, well, I have musical anhedonia. Maybe they would be interested in studying me. So then he got in touch with us and then he ended up driving up from New York. And that's how this project happened.
Wow. So all of those extra like publicity stages that we see in universities, that actually pays off sometimes.
It matters. It's great. It's amazing. Yeah, that was a good secondary learning experience. Was you really do have to work with your department and your university in getting the word out about your research, especially if we're doing human research and we depend on humans to bring, you know, to bring ideas and bring the actual brains.
So how did BW know that he was music anhedonic?
He has always been in the musical family, and he, I guess, had quite a lot of music around him growing up, but he always knew that he never felt anything about music, and he recalls these experiences of his brother, in his words, forcing him to listen to music that he liked in the basement you know, with a bunch of other friends, and all these friends were really getting into it, and he just felt nothing. And he likened it to an in the closet experience. And he was always very interested in other forms of art. Like he's a photographer. He goes to art galleries. And then he would join these art appreciation groups where they would go to see an art gallery together and they would have a great time. And then during this, the other members would be talking about this Wagner opera that they also saw. And he would just feel nothing. So I think he always felt that there was something different about the way he relates to music. And he would say things like, oh, I would watch people standing in the checkout line at grocery stores and kind of bopping to music and their headphones. And I would wonder why they would want to do that. So I think he was always observing other people's behavior that was so different from the way he felt. And then once he likened this again to a coming out of the closet experience where he told the friends in his art appreciation group that he just never felt anything for music and never had. And after that, somebody pointed him to, I think it was an NPR broadcast about musical anhedonia. And that's how he found out that that's what he has.
Wow. That's all very useful for for music cognition people. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a series of fortunate events. Seriously. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that it's an experience that's been distressing for him at times, but it is a fascinating opportunity. So you're aware of BW, but there's a long sort of stretch between interesting case study and what you actually did for this. How did you decide to do this setup?
Well, I think when we saw his data, I mean, and again, the internet is really helpful in this in this case. I mean, we have a lot of tests now, that screening tests that we can put online. And so, of course, to really qualify as being truly musically anhedonic, you have to not have a bunch of other diseases and disorders. You can't just be generally anhedonic. You can't have amusia, right? So we had all these screening tools that we had set up online, and just having him do those online, it became very clear that it's a pretty unique case. And that's when we invited him to drive up from New York, where he lives, and we scheduled the MRI, and we scheduled the time in the lab, and we really designed some experiments around him. So I think it was really a few months in the making, but it involved my then lab manager, Emily Presinda, and now master's student, Sean Patterson. I mean, they really put a lot of time and just effort into making all these things possible.
Mm-hmm. So you saw some specific research tools that I know I'm less familiar with. For example, you were using diffusion tensor imaging as opposed to other types of brain imaging. What is it about this technique that you find useful for this kind of work?
Well, it's really useful for visualizing brain connectivity and brain structure. And when I'm talking about brain connectivity and structure, I'm talking about white matter pathways that connect gray matter. Right? So we know that in general, the brain consists of neurons, which have gray matter, which are actually the cell bodies, and white matter, which are the axons that communicate between the cells. So the idea was that there might be some disconnect between areas of the brain that are important for perception and areas of the brain that are important for processing reward. And the DTI, I think, lends itself very well to these kinds of hypotheses.
How do you measure diffusion tensor imaging stuff?
Right. So it's a type of use of MRI, right? So you go into the MRI, just like you would for functional MRIs, and you would lie there, and the scanner collects these different volumes of water diffusion information. And so by that, we mean we're looking at comparing the movement of water between different times, subtly different times. And you can apply a gradient that says, like, now we're interested in water diffusion in one direction, now we're interested in water diffusion in a second direction, and a third direction, and a fourth direction, and so on. So you can end up with 100 different directions. And by comparing, right, all of those different directions together, you end up with a distribution of the preferred diffusion directions of water molecules. And so that gives you an idea of, you know, how things are connected, because if two areas of the brain, for instance, are well connected to each other, then water wants to diffuse more between those regions than in other possible directions, right? So by mapping out this diffusion space, right, within every little pixel of the brain, you can build a map of the connection properties of the major white matter pathways of the brain.
Huh. So you're looking at, is this like water moving within cells that you're capturing?
It could be within cells, it could be between cells, it could be across membranes or not across membranes, right? So yeah, okay. So we don't really have that that level of resolution,
but you have a sense of the patterns associated with the orientation of axons, and so
exactly.
You can extrapolate then the white matter connectivity,
right?
Okay.
And I think, again, it's a really quickly moving field. So I've seen the methods become better over time. And so, I mean, this is kind of a snapshot of like the best we've got right now.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's going to move towards, you know, always moving towards higher resolution or combination of multiple types of data and multiple scans, so that you can get a better picture of the biological properties underlying these diffusion patterns.
Yeah. Is DTI kind of new then?
Well, I think it's been around since the 90s, but it was much more experimental in the 91. It's, you know, it became clear that, you know, the papers published showed that you can differentiate between white matter and gray matter using this method. And then by, I'd say, mid-2000s, you know, you could do this on the whole brain, and you can see these differences between patient populations and controls, right? So let's say schizophrenics, right? They have like very different patterns of white matter structure and white matter integrity, you know, which includes things like myelination, which is important for the white matter. So that became clear. And then by late 2000s, you know, I was starting to look at that in music.
Okay.
You know, but I think the idea that white matter is useful for subserving behavior has been around since the 19th century, right?
Yeah.
So the classic cases of Broca's and Wernicke's, and then the conduction aphasia, which is the lack of connection between Broca's area and Wernicke's area. people with that conduction aphasia can't repeat sentences that are spoken to them.
And that's a very specific thing.
But I think it dips into a number of general cognitive abilities.
Yeah.
Sometimes those clinical observations, so they seem so specific, but it's actually like a bunch of different, really general cognitive capacities, right? So that's been known since the 19th century.
So if you were, for example, comparing the results of an fMRI study to do with music anhedonia and a DTI study to do with music anhedonia, like, where do these things meet?
Well, I think the relationship between structure and function is always quite interesting. I mean, I think partly why we didn't veer towards a task fMRI design was that it's quite hard to really directly compare the experiences in the scanner for BW and for controls in a way that's meaningful and not kind of trivial to my mind. I mean, if you already know that BW doesn't get emotions to music, like playing him music and then having him not get emotional is kind of, it's kind of a circular, right?
Yeah.
So I think, the real question becomes like, how is his brain wired differently, and how did it become this way? And so, so I think looking at structural connectivity, I think it's closer to the fundamental problem. I mean, that said, I think that functional connectivity is a really good thing to look at too. And so we also have resting state functional MRI data, which is looking at correlations of areas being active over time. And with that information, we'll hope to get at how his brain functions differently in the general, not while it's listening to music.
So besides DTI, you also use the Barcelona Music Reward Questionnaire. I mean, it's only 20 questions. It's not very long, but it touches on 5 different aspects of music and reward. Did that get at what you wanted, do you think?
Well, I think it's the best tool we've got right now, or the most consistently used tool we have right now for looking at individual differences in music and reward. I think just like any test, like it's like reasonably sensitive. But, does it really capture everything that music and reward is? I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that the paper, it was Mas Herrero, 2013, right, was the paper that first reported this survey. They designed this survey and they tested it on a large number of controls. And I think that's a very well-designed tool, but I think just like any tool, it's useful for identifying a normal group. And then like if somebody is many standard deviations away from the norm, like BW is, it's sensitive for that too. But by definition, if you'll get a distribution of quote unquote normal responses, and then you can get quite arbitrary in how you decide to draw that line between normal and not normal.
Yeah.
Right. So I mean, I think 5 standard deviations away from the mean is like pretty clearly an outlier. But if you say like 2 standard deviations away from the mean, right? So just by the way the normal distribution works and by the way variability works in humans, like just some percentage of the time, like 2.5% of the time, you're going to have people who are 2 or more standard deviations below the mean.
Yeah.
So do you call those anhedonic or do you call those like tail end of a distribution, right?
Yeah. So you have this experiment set up that's looking at a distribution of sensitivity to music hedonic elements through the Barcelona Music Reward Questionnaire across a sort of normal, quote-unquote normal, standard population of students. Right. And then you have this particular person who's an extreme case, and you're looking at them both behaviorally and through connectivity. So how were you bringing these results into comparison?
Well, I think that it's always a goal in my lab, and I think in cognitive neuroscience in general, to look at relationships between behavior and the brain. And I think when you look at a survey tool like the BMRQ and you look at this distribution of responses, I mean, I think it's a natural question to ask, or how does that relate to individual differences in brain structure? Mm-hmm. And so since we already had a group of white matter tracts that we were interested in, and we'd already compared BW against the controls, right? Then the next question becomes, well, given that we have a fairly large sample of controls, right, how do these tracts correlate with individual differences in musical reward? And I think there's a lot of thinking to be done on how best to make those come together, as you say. I mean, but I think since a lot of white matter tracks tend to be correlated with each other, just looking at simple correlations might not be as informative as putting all these tracks together into a multiple regression. Mm-hmm. So that's what we ended up doing.
Okay. All right. So you combined information from connectivity properties of key regions and had those in a multiple regression to describe the behavioral results you were getting.
Right. So this way we could look at the contribution of each individual pathway in the brain while taking into account the contribution of all the other pathways.
Right. And you were looking at several pathways, right? Well, why don't you describe the regions that were really key, your regions of interest in this
study?
Yeah,
they're really coming out of the new literature on musical anhedonia, and on the reward system quite generally, much of it coming out of the Barcelona group who designed the BMRQ, of course. Mm-hmm. So what we wanted to know was how are the auditory and reward regions connected. So the auditory regions include the superior temporal gyrus, which is close to the primary auditory cortex. Mm-hmm. And then the reward regions include the insula, anterior portion of the insula, the nucleus accumbens, which is really the seat of reward, and then also the medial prefrontal cortex. And we chose these regions of interest partly because of work from from the Barcelona group, but also because of our previous work. So Matt Sox and in his paper in 2016, right, he examined these regions and showed that people who tend to get chills when they listen to music have more connectivity between these regions. Mm-hmm. Right? So between the auditory regions and the superior temporal gyrus and the anterior insula and the medial prefrontal cortex. And then that was modulated by connections to the nucleus accumbens. And so these regions had popped up from previous work as being important for auditory and reward processing.
Right. So you had your sections of the brain to focus on, and are there connections that were key to this? And you applied this established test. Did the results come out as you expected?
Well, yes and no. I think that the fact that we see a smaller volume between the superior temporal gyrus and the nucleus accumbens, that was really what we predicted.
So that's a smaller volume in BW compared
to the
normal population.
Correct. Yeah. So what we hadn't expected as much was that BW also had higher fraction anisotropy. And fraction anisotropy, people think of that as an index of white matter integrity. So that really means a combination of things. It means myelination. It means better coherence between axonal fibers. It means less crossing fibers. So the finding that there's higher FA in BW was unexpected. So it's as if BW just had less of a pathway, but a more
a smoother
connected
pathway.
A smoother pathway.
That's very hard for me to understand. You know, I mean, there's, I think, to make an association with functional fMRI, sometimes we think of lower activity as being a sign of lower engagement for a region. And sometimes we think of lower activity, let's say between individuals, as an indication of efficiency, like it works better. And those are kind of opposite interpretations that suit opposite explanations for the same kind of pattern here. And looking at these results from my position, I can't tell if these are just like sort of supporting different interpretations based off of these two different measures.
I think that the literature always compares volume as well as FA. We can also look at some other diffusion properties as well, like mean diffusivity and radial and axial diffusivity. And there's some hints that those correspond to different things like myelination versus coherence. Mm-hmm. But I think one possible interpretation is that this might be an inhibitory pathway, or there might be more inhibition. And that's kind of a post hoc explanation. It's a bit like saying efficiency, but if everybody has this pathway, BW has a more inhibitory pathway, right? That might explain higher fractional anisotropy and lower,
right?
Yeah, while having a lower volume.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, and that's a really good point, is that sometimes the connections between regions are sort of supporting activity, you know, from one bit to another, but sometimes those connections are dampening or inhibitory, and so are sort of saying, well, if this is active, by the way, this shouldn't be as well. And so if that's what's going on, if as opposed to a, you know, an activating pathway, he is a more inhibitory pathway, then that would be consistent with his results. And
right. Or it might be that there are both activating or inhibitory and excitatory pathways, right, within this, yeah, within this pathway, but that BW only has one, not the other.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah. So I think we're still working, puzzling it out.
Yeah.
You know, and hopefully over the years, we'll see better imaging tools, maybe higher resolution, maybe other techniques of analysis that kind of give you some hint as to whether you're looking at inhibitory or excitatory pathways. I don't think we're quite there yet. Yeah, but I think, I mean, that's another kind of important side point, but it's important for science quite generally, is that, I mean, the FA findings surpassed the Bonferroni correction threshold, right? So, you know, so when you have multiple pathways that you're testing, there's a multiple comparisons problem, yeah, right? Where you know, you're testing so many things, and just by chance, something might become statistically significant. So this was not that. I mean, so you can correct for that by you know, adjusting your alpha levels, or, you know, the chance levels beyond which you have to say that something is statistically significant. And this really was significant after you correct for the fact that we were looking at multiple pathways.
Not only was there a regional thing, there was also lateralization, right? You had, I shouldn't say right when talking about brains. so there was there was this effect on the right side of the brain, but there wasn't a corresponding effect on the left. And was that as expected as well, that difference?
Well, no, but I think it wasn't unexpected. I mean, I think that there's this old idea that right hemisphere does more of the work when it comes to emotion. And I don't think that's quite supported anymore. In our last paper, right, Sachs et al., we found the differences to be bilateral, right? So between people who get chills and people who don't get chills, right, both hemispheres are better connected between auditory and reward areas in the chills group. So, right. So I think that it's important to test both hemispheres.
One of the most interesting parts I thought about this paper was how you were using the model from the healthy adults to predict BW's scores, and kind of, I guess, failed to predict, or did not do a good job of predicting his behavioral scores, but did a good job of predicting like his brain data.
Yeah.
Is it just because like he was so low behaviorally that there would be basically no model to be able to predict it, or like how do you interpret that?
I think it's really what you said. I mean, I think if you look at the clusters, like this is scatter plots on figure three, right? It's so clear that he behaviorally he's so far off. But his brain is actually not that different. Right. So
yeah.
So that's why, I mean, it's just hard to extrapolate to that far out in behavioral data.
Or rather, what you can measure of his brain doesn't look that different.
Right.
I thought an interesting part in the setup of the paper was like trying to determine whether musical anhedonia is just normal variation on the low end of a continuum, or is it like categorically different? Did you come to a conclusion on that point? Do you think it's a different category, or is it just part of a continuum?
I think that if you buy the BMRQ and some other work that's been published on musical anhedonia so far, you have to conclude that it is part of a continuum, right? But if you go with, you know, what you've done, right, which is like looking at different brains with lesions, right, and like seeing who actually has it, I mean, then you kind of have to buy that there's something special about, you know, that they are in a group all by themselves. Yeah, so I think it's like, which way do you look at like a half empty, half full glass, right? So I think it's definitely the tail end of a distribution, but the further along the tail you go, the more it's going to look like a distinct group. And I think it's a bit like amusia too. I mean, having done work on tone deafness for quite a while, I mean, I really feel like this is an even more extreme version of, you know, a slightly different but overall similar phenomenon, which is like you have something unusual, but it happens to be the tail end of distribution. And the more, the further out you get on that distribution, the more you'll see like really unusual behavior.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think it seems like you could probably have varying degrees of musical anhedonia. People can have more or less of it. And that actually reminds me of something that I thought was interesting in your paper, was that BW also reported anhedonia for other auditory stimuli.
Yeah.
Which I thought was actually kind of surprising. Like, this is totally anecdotal, but I was doing a radio interview on musical anhedonia for this NPR station, and listeners were calling in and were saying like, hey, I think I have that, but that's why I listen to NPR, because I still like listening to like people, you know, like talk radio. So I just didn't know if you could comment more on that. Like, does BW really not like listen to anything? Or
right, no, I think it's the same. I think BW is the same as the person who called onto your show. I mean, he also listens to NPR, right? Because he can't bear to listen to music. I think it starts with music, but it extends to musical sounds or to extra musical sounds, right? But I think it does not extend to speech, right? So if somebody read a really wonderful poem, right, he would still be able to say that that's a wonderful poem, not necessarily because of the sounds of it, right, but because he's able to like form some tactic structure and understand semantics and so on. And I think that, you know, by the time you're BW's age, which is early 50s, right, I mean, you've lived so many years as like trying to overanalyze like your lack of emotional responses that I could see how it might generalize to other things. I mean, and the questions on the physical anhedonia scale that are non-musical sounds include things like rustling of the leaves, right? So like, I think if I were introspective musical anhedonic, I might like listen to these things and like, you know, maybe I would have had the experience where somebody else remarks on how wonderful the rustling of the trees sounds. And then I would think, oh, but I never got it for music, so I also don't get it for this. So I think there's some kind of top-down pathways going on there. But I think it really deserves teasing apart. It does beg like a more general question of non-musical sounds in music, right? When do people actually find that pleasurable, and why do people find it pleasurable? Is it because of like other long-term associations we've made? You know, I think that's it's there's a lot there.
Something that a lot of people that listen to, let's say, sample-based music report is a capacity to just listen to things musically. And that I'm not aware of a lot of systematic study on what happens when someone sort of turns on their musical ears that way. But that's more complicated than just, you know, changing how you're perceiving pitch or applying a meter to whatever's going on. So I feel like there's a lot that we don't know that maybe we could learn about then what is distinctly musical in the processing of things like the rustling of leaves or all of that stuff.
We also know like there's a mere exposure effect, right? Like if you listen to a sampled sound for a long time, chances are you will find it more pleasurable.
Yes. So strangely, you will find it pleasurable.
So strangely. Perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that turning on and off your musical ear, that's a really great quote. And we don't really know what that is yet. I think that's a really good point.
I am very interested about BW sort of feeling a disconnect from the pleasures of sounds generally versus sounds that are specifically musical, and how possibly he can still get pleasure from things that have other associations like speech. You know, speech is a very rich kind of sound signal. I sort of, to just be really crude about this, if, for example, there is an inhibitory effect of the superior temporal gyrus on the nucleus accumbens, then you would think that that would potentially affect lots of sounds and he would just experience pleasure less when there was sound. What his behavior suggests, if he does find pleasure in listening to NPR, is that that is not the case, right? It is not so gross as to just flatten out the experience or inhibit pleasurable experience just because there is activity in these regions more generally. It has to be more refined than that. It is more specific than that.
Right. And I think that to the extent other areas get brought in, right, like language that you would hear on NPR, right, that you know, that obviously includes engages a bunch of areas that we don't we haven't looked at in this, right? So like things like the Broca's area, or you know, or areas in the frontal lobe, more generally, right? And like middle temporogyrus, those areas we didn't talk about, but they are very important for language, and certainly they would have to go through those areas as well to derive, let's say, pleasure from poetry, right, or from like a meaningful conversation.
So this kind of leads into then your framing of this article and your framing of this research as related to evolutionary theories of music, and in particular bringing in the mixed origins theory of music. So can you explain what the mixed origins of music theory is and how you see the connection?
Yeah, I think it's a really nice response to the TTM, transformative technology of the mind idea, which itself is a really nice response to the whole auditory cheesecake idea. You know, so like the auditory cheesecake idea, you know, being that music has no adaptive value, it's like cheesecake. And I think a lot of music cognition researchers take issue with that because, you know, music does a lot of things and we use it in a lot of conditions, and it wouldn't have been around for so long and in so many cultures if it didn't do something. And so like Darwin, right, would have, you know, said, well, males might use music to attract females, right? So sexual selection might be, you know, might be one explanation. But then there's problems with that theory as well, because, you know, when you have groups of people singing together, they don't, you know, that's not necessarily going to be sex.
That's not a precursor to an orgy.
Exactly. I was like inhibiting going there.
It's okay. We can say that kind of thing here.
That's awesome. Right. So there's group music, right? And you know, and like mother infant singing, right? So, so I think that there's a lot more functions than that. And then I think what Ani Patel's TTM theory, I mean, how that kind of summarizes it is that we use music to transform our minds, right? So, and that also dovetails quite well with the Singing Neanderthals, right? The book by Steve Mithin, right? That says that music and language kind of evolved from a proto language, right? So from these cognitive and neural precursors to both. And I think that's what's really useful for the field. And then Altmuller came along and said, you know, what are those cognitive and neural precursors? And he thought that the chills response, right, because it's a direct kind of auditory access to this reward system and to this alarm calling system, you know, and it includes expectations that we know to be very important in the way kind of music works, is that it sets up our expectations and then either fulfills them or violates, and we find that to be pleasurable. And so I think of this work as providing some support for that, because, you know, when you're looking at pathways that are kind of connecting auditory areas and reward areas, you're really looking at that direct auditory reward connection, right? That might be the precursor to these music and language overlap. You know that's important for TTM. Yeah, so I think of it as kind of providing more meat on the MOM theory.
So because this is looking at population variation on this particular connection to this reward system, it's consistent with this theory that also posits the mechanisms that support chills are mechanisms that would support the development of language and music in some mixture together.
I think so, right? I mean, and I think that if you compare lots of different species, right, it's not clear how many species have language and how many species have music, right? That's obviously a very active area of research, but a lot of species have a reward system.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and it's a very well-studied system in animals that don't clearly have music.
I mean, right. They do have calls, and a lot of animals have group call behavior and that's that sort of stuff. So there's things that might be related to that enjoyment. I guess what I wonder about is using chills to study this kind of mechanism. I mean, chills are an extreme, right? It's kind of like trying to explain, excuse me for going into the sexual realm again, but it's like trying to explain sexual behavior just from the orgasm. Like there's obviously other mechanisms towards pleasure and reward that maybe aren't easily extrapolated from that particular event.
Yeah, I think chills are an extreme, but I think like feeling pleasure is not extreme. And if you look at individuals, I mean, if you ask a large group of people, like, have you ever felt a chill or when you listen to music, like a lot of people will say yes. Maybe it's just the people I hang out with, but like, I mean, even in like general, like a classroom, you'll get a lot of hands raising. I mean, they might not think of that as like normal or common or like a part of their lives that they really particularly think about. But I think the idea that like strong emotional experiences give you physiological changes, that's not so unusual, right?
No,
I think that that's where all the skin conductance work comes from. And I think that music gives you strong emotional responses, or can give you strong emotional responses, right? It just depends on what music, and you have to find the right music for the right person and so on.
And the right circumstances that,
Right, the right circumstances, the right life experiences, right? I think that's also not so far-fetched, right? But it's just that it might just be like the fact that the people who study chills have or strong emotional responses are not the same people who study music cognition quite generally, and so it ends up feeling like this small niche thing, but it's actually quite common.
Well, I don't mean to suggest that chills are rare, but then in terms of someone's lifetime, you spend more time, generally speaking, it seems, given the results of the study of music and reward, there's you spend a lot of time finding pleasure in music in a way that doesn't lead to that particular kind of peak.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, hopefully there's a connection of that spectrum to that peak.
I
But
think it is a spectrum, and I think that, I mean, we'll end up talking more and more about distributions versus outliers.
yeah,
You know,
yes.
but I think like a chill is it's a very strong experience of pleasure. But you can think of a continuum of pleasure as well. And like a lot of music is like, low pleasure, but like kind of pleasurable, like better than nothing, right? And I think that's probably quite general.
Well, then this brings me to a general question, which is how do you think this research relates to, let's say, someone's day-to-day experience of music listening today? Is it, do you feel like we can say that as someone is, enjoying music that they're listening to, I don't know, over headphones while standing in the subway, say, as a lot of people do in New York, we would just expect that then there would be a lot of activity between the superior temporal gyrus and the nucleus accumbens, because that's just part of this process of getting pleasure. Would that be then the sort of the main or a necessary mechanism for them too, as they're listening to whatever Spotify is giving them today?
Right. Yeah, I think that's No, I think you just gave me my a new research idea for my next fMRI
Good.
study. I mean, I think that attention matters a lot, right? I mean, and I think that we can turn on the chills experience if we want to, right? Like if you think of your favorite piece of music, right? I mean, if you happen to be listening to it in like a fairly stressful environment, you would probably not pay as much attention to it, and you'll probably not get the chill response to it because you're so busy attending to whatever needs to be attended to right now. But like the reason why a lot of people say that when they're commuting or when they're in their car or whatever, like right, suddenly like they get this chills, it's because commuting and car driving is like fundamentally pretty boring experiences, and so you do have that cognitive resource necessary to like orient your attention towards the chills, right? So I mean towards the music itself, and that then enhances that experience of chills. So I think how our top-down state, or how our attention modulates the way in which the acoustic signals are processed bottom up to engage the reward system. I think that's a really important question, and we know that there's got to be a role, but I don't think any paper has really systematically tested that.
That kind of reminds me of this paper that Dennis Pelley and Abe Realman just came out with in the Current Biology from NYU, where they looked at the experience of beauty in response to visual stimuli and found that like doing a concurrent task, I think they use an NBAC task, disrupted the experience of beauty. So it's kind of, I think, related to what you're saying, the intentional thing that like if your cognitive resources are diverted elsewhere, then it's really hard to find beauty or pleasure in other things, I guess.
Yeah, I'm reminded of that Joshua Bell playing in the New York subway, or was it Washington, D.C. subway? right? He was playing the Bach Chaconne. You know, this is a couple of years ago, right? He was playing the Bach Chaconne at like a busy commuting hour, and like nobody stopped to listen to him. And this is, and he made like $40 over an hour or something. Whereas, like, this is the guy that gets, you know, paid, I don't know how much, many more orders of magnitude than that when he's playing Carnegie Hall, right? Yeah, I mean, so I think that, yeah, we have to be primed to find beauty.
So then could it be that musical anhedonia is really just like a failure of attention or something, that like they are unable to identify like or attend to like the right parts of music? I don't know.
But if their attention has been directed to it, like BW's younger brother has said, or has like made him sit in the basement and like listen to this thing, like, and he still failed to get it. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I think there are some cases where you can't even turn it on if you try.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a lot, again, like the amusia literature, right? Like a lot of people, like they're not tone deaf, but they will sound kind of bad if they are just aren't paying attention to it, right? Or if they're not well trained. And so they might even self-identify as being amusic, but they're not, right? Yeah, but if you're really trying and you're really paying attention and you still just can't hit a note, right, then that starts to suggest a disorder.
Right. Then that's, again, the categorical versus the spectrum distinction, right, is whether the flexibility won't be there if there is a categorical difference.
Right.
In your condition. Though obviously there's some spectrum differences that still cannot be negotiated or adjusted through practice or training or attention. I don't mean to suggest that goes that way, but wow. All right. So do you have any follow-up studies in the works? Or you mentioned that you were looking at resting state activity in BW and the rest of your population.
Right. Yeah, we also have some behavioral results that are looking at, I mean, just following up on the idea of what exactly BW can perceive. I mean, and the idea about non-musical sound items, right? Like whether he can perceive the emotions from sounds, right? Like if somebody just laughs, like does he know that it's a happy sound, right? So I think behavioral experiments like that, that we have a little bit of data on. And then also, I'd like to look more into skin conductance as well, right? Because a lot of what we're using so far for BW is just relies on self-report, right? Yeah. Because the BMRQ, right, obviously relies on him filling out the BMRQ. But if we can get some skin conductance data, I think a psychophysiological marker of the lack of reward responses from music.
All right, cool.
Something I thought of when I was reading this is like, I don't know if it'd be possible to do this study, but like talk to some developmental people. Cause my question is like, is this difference in connectivity in the brain just like a result of decades of not listening to music? Or like, at what point do you realize that you don't like music and then stop listening to it? And that probably changes your brain, you know? So I think it could be interesting to kind of look at like the development of musical anhedonia.
Yeah, that would be really great. I've been trying to get my hands on a bunch of children's DTI right since like the 2000s. And it's I mean there's so many tricky issues, it turns out, like with scanning kids' brains.
I don't know the first thing about it. I was just like wondering, like, how much is this a consequence of his changed behavior based on not liking music?
Yeah. I mean, I think that by this point in his life, he's probably had to change how he listens to music. I mean, he lives a pretty musicless life. And when he hears music, he finds it mildly irritating because everybody else seems to find it so exciting, right? It's not like he hates music, right? He was pretty clear about this. He doesn't hate it. He's just like, he doesn't feel pleasure from it. And then he finds it mildly annoying because everyone does find pleasure in it. And that it's socially debilitating, right? So I think you might start out with a different kind of pathway that then doesn't get used or other pathways that get used more as a compensatory mechanism.
Cool. Well, this is a really great paper, and it was lovely talking to you about this, Psyche. Do you have anything else you want to add before we let you go back to your enjoying not having to do classes right now?
No, I think this has been a lot of fun. We should do this more.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being here, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you very much.
All right. So that was a lot of information. How did you find that?
That was really fun. I like want to do this podcast every week because it's really awesome to just talk to people about, I mean, this stuff happens like at conferences, but it's cool to just talk to people about their papers. It was really fun and interesting, especially just hearing about BW, I think is really cool.
Okay. I'm going to try to summarize this paper just to make sure that I've got this right. So
cool.
This paper looks at the connectivity based off of diffusion tensor imaging of BW, who is a self-reported music anhedonic, and a collection of normal population, which was a bunch of students from Wesleyan University, if I recall correctly, and looks at differences in the connectivity between some very key brain regions to the question of anhedonia, music anhedonia in particular, as well as their behavioral results in this specific behavioral research tool, the Barcelona Music Reward Questionnaire, which has been validated before and used in a number of studies. And the results were that there was a very clear result of difference in the brain regions of the connections between the superior temporal gyrus and the nucleus accumbens on the right side. And while also having lower volume, BW had higher FA, which stands for
fractional anisotropy.
Yes, that, which relates to the smoothness of the connection. Explaining that particular difference of lower volume and higher smoothness is a bit tricky, but the difference was clear, and it could be that this relates to maybe an inhibitory connection between this auditory area and this reward area of the brain. Was there anything that surprised you in what Psyche had to say about the study?
I mean, I think one of the most surprising parts was just recruiting the participant. Like that is wild and really cool. You know, sometimes scientists, I think, are even like skeptical of doing press releases for their work. But it's really cool to have kind of like this success story, I guess.
God, I wish all of my cool, interesting subjects just kind of like volunteered. That would be great. Right. Here, I would like to be a research project, please.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
That's nice. I have to say, I was hoping, because the medial prefrontal cortex was one of the regions that they looked at in the study, I was kind of hoping there would be something more to that, because I'm very interested in, you know, in embodiment and in a kind of an active experience of music. And so that region can be associated with interpreting relationships to other things and kind of putting the self in the overall stuff. That's a very poor explanation of what it does. But anyway, it does a bunch of things, and it's often associated with the involvement of the self in terms of evaluating like value and that sort of thing to oneself. That was kind of like just a little bit of a window open for the argument to be about how someone may be anhedonic because they don't connect personally with what's happening musically. And that wasn't the case. That wasn't the story.
Yeah. So I was also similarly interested in that same brain region in my dissertation, because something I am really interested in is like how music and emotion and autobiographical memory all kind of connect. And I just wonder, like, does someone like BW not have the connection between music and memory? So like, if he hears a song that was played when he was in high school or something, does he not have, or does any musically anhedonic person not have an evoked memory? Or do they? If they do, is it less rich? Like, does music still serve as a as a cue for those kind of things? Or does just they just have no associations with music?
Or would the formation of that memory hinge on the pleasure response that someone could get from the music in that moment?
Do you have to enjoy the music in order to form that kind of strong memory?
Or have some kind of strong emotional response to it? That would justify the retention.
So I don't know. That's something that I've been interested in for a long time and haven't done yet. But talking about the MPFC kind of made me think of that, because presumably that would be a an important structure in that kind of connection.
Well, maybe that'll be something that will come to light soon. If you are music and hedonic, there are a few researchers you could get in touch with. All right. Well, thank you, Amy, for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for listening. And if you enjoyed this, please share this with other music science enthusiasts on social media, or you can find the So Strangely podcast on Twitter, So Strangely Pod on Facebook, on Tumblr. And you can leave us feedback on our website, on the blog at sostrangely.com, or you can email me directly at finn@sostrangely.com. And if you're listening to this and you want to leave a rating or review on like iTunes or other platforms, that would be great because we're brand new and no one knows how to find us yet. So that would be a big help. And if you're an academic in music science and you know of a peers research you'd love to recommend, please check out our contact page at sostrangely.com to pitch an episode. We're always looking for more research. We're looking for new research. So that's within the last 2 years, but we're open to the full range of things that could qualify as empirically motivated music research. That's very broad. Thank you for listening and keep exploring.
Sometimes behave so strangely. Sometimes behave so strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely.